Chapter 11. Road to the Underverse. A century? A day? How long did the fleet of the Space Wolves cleave its way through the troubled Empyrean before it re-emerged? Time liquefied in the warp, running out through faults in creation, leaving a man's soul drowning for lack of minutes, seconds, and hours. It could have been a year, or a decade, or 1,000 years when the translation warning was broadcast across the fleet. The Vilka Fenrika had no fondness for flight. They did not trust countdowns and failsafes. The klaxon sounded in enough time for them to mutter their charms against Maleficarum, before the ship crashed out of the Empyrean, back into the material universe. The ships bucked. Alarms squealed from multiple systems. Reactors beat irregularly, like hearts undergoing arrest. The warp did not want to let its playthings go. The machineries of humanity said otherwise, rending at the membrane between somewhere and nowhere, and pushing out the ships in violent rebirth. The warp rift flared with indigo flames. Space split. The rift formed like a tear in flesh, unevenly ripped by a predator's teeth. Sprays of solidifying corpuscent geysered thousands of kilometers across space. Unlight added a malevolent star to the heavens that was too slow in dying. As wolf ships of Fenris, rigged for ice but encountering open water, the fleet went from one sea to another in disarray, almost foundering on the change of cosmic texture. Real space dragged at their keels. Disturbance, patterning, turned their geller fields into plasma storms of unnatural colour. Blue witchfire clung to tower, spire, and gun barrel. Engine stacks guttered. Smaller ships tumbled uncontrollably end over end. Nidhogg's reactor went offline after it regained real space. The vast ship drifted dangerously across the path of its sisters, necessitating frantic evasion. The fleet scattered like an outmatched wolf pack. The warp rift shut reluctantly, leaving the fleet adrift across sudden darkness. The wolf's eye lit hulls facing the system's center with angry white light. All else was hidden by the hard black shadow only found in the airless void, the killing black, colder than the worst of winters. The Vilka Fenrika remained adrift. Had an enemy come across the fleet during those helpless minutes, they would have found the wolves easy prey. Engines stuttered. Ships recovered. They returned to formation slowly. The void was not the Vilka Fenrika's favoured hunting ground. Once properly arrayed, they trekked inwards to the system core, where Fenris neared the end of its orbital track and the beginning of the end of the season of fire. Fenris turned beneath the ship's keels in the blazing light of the great year's summer.
"Bring us home," the Primarch ordered. "Take us into the Eight."
There was an energy to the command deck. The Legion was pleased to return to their den. Few mountains like the Fang existed in the galaxy. Geography proclaimed it part of a chain of mountains, the Volda Hamaki, the world's spine, whose uplift raised the continent of Azaheim out of the world's crust so far it was beyond remaking. But the Fang was more than simply another peak. 7 mountains made up the world's spine massif, sprawling foothills piled up to the ring of 6 surrounding the Fang. They were giants in their own right that scraped the underside of space with their summits. Any one would have been crowned the king of mountains on another world. But the Fang was of a different order, a conical mass of black granite as tall as the heavens. The summit broke through the planet's atmospheric envelope, sure as a sword thrust. The smaller mountains guarded it, like Legion veterans protecting their lord. In the same way the Legiones Astartes could not compare to their Primarchs, so was the Fang immeasurably greater than the other peaks of Azaheim. The others were linked to it by ridges and treacherous snow bridges, but all their efforts to embrace the Fang ceased halfway to the peak. Bjorn was on the bridge with his betters, trying to stay out of the way. To his disquiet, Kavar had taken to following him about, watching him.
"We return home when Fenris is at its most violent temper," Bjorn said,
for the sake of something to say.
It is glorious. A time of power, said Kvar.
Conversation made his scrutiny no easier to bear. Bjorn issued a noise by way of reply. Fenris was a hard place that bred hard men and hard women. It was famous across the Imperium for its winters. The short summer was lesser known, but just as bad, if not worse. The wolf's eye shone at its largest in the sky. The northern dawn filled the horizon from side to side with white fire. Imperial astronomers opined that if Fenris's solar apsis were a few 100,000 kilometers closer, or if its orbital pass were a few days longer, the world would have been uninhabitable. The sun's furnace beat against the rock of the planet, melting the sea ice and stirring the atmosphere into cataclysmic storms. While the heat of the wolf's eye burned the surface, its gravity tugged at Fenris's heart. Volcanoes awoke and spat their molten blood in broad rivers. As night's terminator cut over them, they glowed in the dark as orange patches and lines that picked out the sutures in the planet's crust. The sky boiled with clouds of soot and ash that flickered with lightning. Higher still, the planet was encased in dazzling aurorae, brought forth by the merciless force of the solar wind. The ground shook. Islands sank into steaming seas, pulled down into the world forge. New lands of black stone were born to replace them, carried to the surface on upwellings of magma. Seas boiled, sending scalding fogs rolling across titanic waves and tides that swamped the highest land. The Hrafnical sailed northwards, over the open seas and plains.
We return at the time of life, said Kvar. The wakefulness of Fenris will aid us.
Tracts of lands buried beneath white snows for 2 Terran years turned a dazzling green, and though fires burned wildly across dry forests, they were too vast to die. Upon the plains of Azaheim, herds of animals, thousands strong, moved across fruitful plains. Antlers clashed in the rut. Predators grew fat on stolen calves. The sea was stained with rusty brown streaks where billions of tons of krill fed, bred, and died. The water churned with monsters, snatching millions of these tiny creatures up in cavernous mouthfuls. As on land, where the sea herds went, there were also things with teeth and claws.
It will not last, Kvar went on. The solstice is days away, and the short road to hell winter beckons. We must be quick.
Fire and frenzied life ravaged the surface, and through it all mankind struggled. In this hellish maelstrom, men and women lived and died, competing with each other for the limited space in which to settle. As their home islands sank, they took to the sea in Wyrm and Wolfboat. If they survived the water and the weather, if they evaded the monsters that swam the oceans, if they managed to overcome the rival tribes, they might find a new place to raise their halls. They might survive. They might live. But they would never prosper. Never that. The struggles of the populace meant little to the Vilka Fenrika. The Fenrisians were heated by winter, hammered by storm, quenched in hellwinter ice, hardened for service in the Legion. So it had always been. For the Sky Warriors, this was but the natural cycle of things. The rout descended to their lofty halls with greater things on their minds than the ordeals of mere men. Nothing was left unsettled by the summer, not even the domain of Leman Russ. Not even the days and nights, for though Azaheim was athwart the pole, it could not rely on regular portions of dark and light. The wolf's eye tugged and pulled, tearing at the earth as a wolf tears at its victims, rocking it on its axis. A summer night at the Fang might last for a week, the next for a few hours. But the mountain stood firm in the face of the sun, defying it to break its stone and soften its roots, to pull it down and melt it in the world's troubled core. As the Legion arrived, one side of the Fang was lit by the sun's harsh white light. On the far side, pitchy shadows lurked. Ultrastratus clouds sped around either side, thousands of meters below the summit. The pearly shine of the stratosphere gave way to the glow of diffuse gases and tortured aurorae long before the top. The upper reaches, where the last gasps of atmosphere clung to the Fang's Peak as gleaming frosts, were occupied by the fortress of the Space Wolves, called the Fang by other men, and the Eight by themselves. Docks for smaller warships reached from the stone of the utmost levels. The part that projected into the void, the Valgard, had yet to be completed, and only half the docks were operational. Work had begun at an astonishing pace after the Wheel of Fire, but the war against Horus had slowed progress to a near standstill. Bjorn wondered if the Eight would ever be finished. Little appeared to have been accomplished since his last visit. Half-made, it was already the greatest fortress outside of the Imperial Palace itself, a vast castle conceived and begun before any other legion had established bases on their own home worlds, and mightier than any that had followed. The smaller ships descended directly to the summit berths girding the Valgard. The rest took up station at high anchor, their passengers leaving aboard gunships and lighters that streamed into hangar slots like bats returning to the roost. Ships scudded into the hangars, the thin blue line of atmospheric barriers painting cross-sections over their hulls. Russ's Stormbird slewed into its bay, turned its aggressive approach into a brief hover before slamming down. This was the route's way. The Rockcrete landing apron was cracked by repeated hard landings. Equally as hard, the boarding ramp slapped into the false stone. No curls came to greet their returning lords. The air forced up the Eight's atmospheric circulation tubes was too thin. Servitors, their organic components enclosed completely against the cold and the lack of oxygen, formed Lehman Russ's welcome party. With them was a single space wolf, helm sealed. He waited for his master to emerge, while other ships performed similar manoeuvres, filling the hangar and others like it nearby with screaming engines and the crash of abused landing gear. Four Wolfguard in cataphracti armour clumped down the ramp of Russ's transport into the landing bay. They paced outwards, alive to threat even in the heart of their Primarch's fortress. Lehman Russ followed after. Alone of all the others spilling from their craft into the Eight, he went helmless. His breath wisped in the rarefied air.
"Friedrich," he said.
He strode over to the lone legionary and hauled him up into a bear's clasp, then held him at arm's length.
"Good to see you. I trust you kept the fires lit and the whites away while we've been gone."
The Primarch panted lightly as he spoke. The air was so thin it tested even his lungs.
"All is as it should be, my lord," said Fritvilch.
His voice crackled out of his helm. The last place in the hangar was taken, and Fritvilch raised his hand. Doors closed over the apertures. The sighing of atmosphere pumps raising the air's pressure became audible as the whine of engines spooling down died.
"The feasting halls are prepared. The Eight welcomes back the warriors to their den. It is too long since the sons of Fenris returned to hearth and home."
Russ's good humour fled.
"Aye," he said, "if only more had come back alive. Best alert the fleshmakers before the feast masters. Too many of our brothers are sleeping on the red snow. There's a bitter take of frozen gene seed to be harvested."
He abruptly pushed past Fritvilch, leaving the hearth watcher stunned at the sudden shift in his humour. The wolf guard clumped past him, wolf pelts swaying from their broad-armoured shoulders. A warrior of Trar followed the Primarch. Fritvilch did not recognise him, but his markings showed him to be Pack Alpha, and his name to be Bjorn. His left hand was encased in a fine lightning claw. Russ was not in the habit of being accompanied by such lowly warriors. His presence puzzled Fritvilch. The warrior, this Bjorn, tapped Fritvilch on the shoulder with the tip of an inactive claw blade. Metal squealed on metal.
"Don't be aggrieved, Watchmaster," he said. There is a bad weird on the Lord of Wolves.
Who are you to tell me this? Said the Watchmaster, who outranked Bjorn by several degrees and was irked by the Packmaster's manner.
It is simple, said Bjorn dolefully. I share it.
Bjorn hung back before joining his brothers at the moot feast. He might not have joined them at all had Fifth Godsmote not spotted him at the edge of the firelight circle.
Bjorn!
Godsmote called out.
Bjorn! By the old father!
Godsmote rose up and engulfed Bjorn in a crushing hug, pulling him into the pack's feasting space.
Oh, bah! It's been too long, my old friend, said Godsmote. I thought the Primarch would never let you go.
I have been away from you for only a while, but much has happened. It has proved too long.
Bjorn looked over Godsmote's shoulder. The pack's losses from Prospero and Alaxis had been filled by men whose masks Bjorn did not know well.
While they have been trailing after us like a whelp on Terra, our packmates have already begun to form the warrior bond with our new brothers.
Bjorn pitched his voice low so only Godsmote could hear.
Ah! You old misery,
said Godsmote, holding Bjorn at arm's length. He smiled broadly, but his actions only made Bjorn conscious of his own missing limb.
My brothers, this is Bjorn, our pack leader,
Godsmote said to the pack.
That you have to say that says it all, said Bjorn.
Fifth Godsmote had taken Bjorn's place in his absence, a temporary role that had the scent of permanence to it. When the new warriors greeted Bjorn, they looked to Godsmote for approval. Bjorn was a stranger, and his association with Leman Russ put more distance still between them.
Sit down, drink. Tell us of your time with the Primarch. You must have much to say, said one.
Not really, said Bjorn. The Wolf King is, as you would expect, he keeps nothing back from his sons.
Why don't you tell me of your battles? There have been many I have not shared.
They obliged, the younger ones eager to impress. Bjorn half listened. The Hall of Tra was not so full as it once was. Every fire pit was lit, showing that many tables were empty. Those Vilka who remained alive were raucous and filled the smoky chamber with their revelry. But though the feast was loud, there was an emptiness beyond the shouted jests and the singing of the old songs. Echoes haunted them from places where more living noise should come, but only whites lurked. The Legion was deeply wounded. Bjorn could not imagine seeing all the benches full ever again. A quarter of Tra's strength was lost, and his great company had fared better than others. On had been particularly hard hit. Many had died with Lord Gunn. Russ had taken to speaking often with Bjorn, the unwanted confidence bringing him yet more discomfort. The Primarch rued the Jarl's recklessness, but so far as Bjorn could see, Russ was set upon a similar course of action. 2/3 of the Legion had already died. Fife's Hall was funereal. Sepp's too. It was all too easy to imagine everyone empty and all feasting done. In the past, when this had happened, the hurt had been made good. Not this time. These were the end times. The days of the God's War, when Morkai would race through the heavens and reclaim his lost eye from the night.
Bjorn?
Said Godsmote. He rested a hand on Bjorn's shoulder. Bjorn blinked. The pack looked at him expectantly. Those that knew him well half smiled. The younger pack members stared. They had finished their stories. Bjorn had heard little of them.
Good tales, brave actions, said Bjorn earnestly. Your courage will give the Skjalds much to think of.
He stood carefully.
I thank you for the drink and for your stories. Now I must away. I have matters to attend to.
Godsmote looked at him in concern.
Aye. More dealings with our lord, Leman Russ, no doubt,
he said to the others, with an enthusiasm his eyes could not match. He embraced Bjorn again.
I understand your need for solitude, he whispered in Bjorn's ear. But do not be a stranger, my brother. come back to us soon. This is your pack, not mine.
Godsmote's sympathy burned at Bjorn as keenly as any insult, and he left with as much dignity as he could muster. Bjorn hunted out a quiet spot, away from all others. There he drank Mjod until his head spun. While in his cups, a powerful melancholy overcame him. With the tip of his long black fingernail, Bjorn scratched a symbol into the stone tabletop, one as old as humanity, the warding eye. Bjorn had never been completely at one with his fellows. The hearty mockery that passed between the Vilka Fenrika came hard to him. The others thought him dour. If he had his way, he would lead his pack in battle with honour and be left in peace when not fighting. The close living of the eight grated at him. He hated to be enclosed. Give him the open skies and the cold, keen wind laced with prey scent. His nose twitched in memory of his solitary hunts. Alas, there would be no time for stalking. The Legion's stay at the Eight was to be measured in days. Above the unfinished Valgard, the Forge Carls and Blade Makers raced to effect further repairs to the battered warships of the Wolves. The stump of his left arm itched. He sank further into his private miseries, his glowering countenance hidden by his leather mask. Soon, Bjorn was drunk. When he gulped his Mjod, it spilled into his beard. He didn't care. Jarl Ogvai Ogvai Helmschut held court from the high table. His manner towards Bjorn had cooled in recent months. Bjorn didn't blame him. How was a Jarl supposed to treat a warrior so unconventionally elevated? There were customs and hierarchies in the Vilka Fenrika, as there were in all societies. Ras had defied them. Ogvai had taken to ignoring him, though not from envy. Bjorn's favouring had the smack of weird to it. Fated men were ill-omened, for they brought death to others as they followed their bloody thread to its end.
Horsa, I've become like Caspar Horsa, slurred Bjorn.
He truly was a bad star.
I should have let him die on the ice, Bjorn thought glumly. Ever since I shot down his ship and decided to rescue him, my threat has been snarled, he added aloud.
Bjorn called a curl to him and bade him fill his horn to the brim. Carl's mask was that of a Signetti. Bjorn squinted at him. The leather was pale grey, rather than red-brown, and furred like the beast it represented. The mask wavered. The few mannish features the mask allowed him to see melted away. The beast was real. The Carl was a Varadfing, a shapeshifter. Bjorn started, knocking his horn and startling the Carl, who once more became a man in a mask. The illusion vanished. Bjorn sent him away with an angry stare, watching him until he disappeared into the smoky gloaming. His gaze dropped to his horn. Mjod shimmered in the well of the vessel, dark as blood. He drank again. In the space before the high table, axe games were underway, and the spear catch and other violent sports. Ogvai whooped and hammered his Mjod horn harder than all the others upon the tables, as a warrior fumbled a catch and the spear point opened up his forearm. The revelry seemed a sham to Bjorn. Helmschrott was trying too hard. The clash of empty lances and horns was similar to the funeral racket performed to drive the wights of the newly dead down into the underverse, where they could not harm the living.
All wrong, he muttered into his drink. It's all bloody wrong.
In Bjorn's body, the Allfather's gifts fought a losing battle with the Mjod. Bjorn's eyelids drooped.
Bjorn the fell-handed!
Bjorn came back to wakefulness, spilling his drink in his haste to reach the short iron sword he wore at his side. Only one called him by that name. A figure in grey battle-plate had appeared in front of him, as uncanny as a wight emerging from the night. Two others lurked nearby, their white armour giving them the appearance of phantoms. All three were armoured and armed for war. Bjorn woozily looked up at the haggard face of Kvar, who is divided.
Kvar, he said.
Stay your hand, said the rune priest. Do not draw your blade.
A cloak of quiet enveloped them, drawing in the shadows like blankets, so the dark seemed sharper around Bjorn's hiding place. The noise of the feast faded and deepened, like a vox record played too slowly. The dance of the fires lost its vitality. The flicker of flame became a soporific strobe. Ogvai and the rest continued their feasting with arrested motion, slowed by the shaman's trick. The carles that moved among the Vilka changed. Like the server who had brought Bjorn his drink, they became animals that walked upon two legs and held their pitchers of miod in fang and claw.
Maleficarum, he said.
He did not draw his sword, but his hand remained upon the hilt.
No witchcraft. The soul of Fenris works upon our threats, said Kvar.
What do you want, Boneshaker? Said Bjorn.
He could not keep his eyes from the beast people, drifting like mist from table to table.
What do I want? It is not what I want. It is what your weird requires of you, said Kvar.
Bjorn let out a bitter laugh, halfway to the howl of misery of a wolf rejected by his pack.
My weird asks a lot of me.
It will ask more of you. Much more, said Kvar sternly.
He did not approve of Bjorn's self-pity. Kvar held out his hand in a fist, palm down. The power armor shook with palsy.
Why, said Bjorn in despair, why must I be separated from my brothers? Why must I bear this burden? Why not a jarl or a goatee? I am nothing.
This is why, said Kvar.
He turned his hand upwards and opened it. Upon Kvar's palm was a rune, scorched into a wooden tile. The symbol had many meanings. While its mystic significance could be interpreted accurately only by the Goti, its mundane meaning was known by all the Vilka Fenrika. Bear. It was the rune for bear. Kvar laid the rune on the table, next to Bjorn's rough, apotropaic eye.
Tomorrow is the solstice, when Fenris is closest to the wolf's eye, said Kvar. Tomorrow, the door to the underverse cracks ajar.
Bjorn's eyes widened. Kvar's ravaged features filled a world crowded with glowering spirit animals.
You will come to the crack guards with the Primarch.
What?
Tomorrow.
Bjorn lifted his head suddenly from the table, coming awake from a drunken stupor. Already, his ulitic kidney was purging the toxins from his blood, and his head was clear. The feast continued, as it should, full of a warrior's joy at life. He blinked. For a moment he thought he must have slept, for there was no sign of Kvar in the hall, but his eye fell on the rune tile on the table, its scorched lines challenging him. Instinctively, Bjorn reached for his miod horn. He raised it to his lips, but stopped, and slowly held it from him and poured the miod away onto the floor. Before he left, he scratched out the eye on the table. They set out at dawn from the sunrising gate, as the wolf's eye was making its move against the world. The gate was only a third of the way up the fang, but from the causeway leading down from the mountain, the curve of the world was visible, and the Volda Hamaki bent across it like a brigandine of studded plates wrapped around a barrel-chested warrior. A rim of fire emerged over the peaks as the gates opened, white and vicious, an arc that filled a quarter of the horizon. So close was the sun during the season of fire that its edge lost constancy and writhed with the serpents of coronal ejection. A king standing over his defeated enemy, the wolf's eye rose over Fenris, and the earth quaked in response. Valdramani, the wolf moon, skulked on the opposite horizon, blanched by the sun's ferocity. Storms sped over the lower mountains, lashing the slopes with vicious squalls. The snow of winter had gone, and all but the very largest glaciers were undergoing violent summer melts. Water raced through every gully, brown as ale, wetting the blades of the mountain ridges with their erosive force. Lightning crackled around the mountain tops. All the while, the earth shook and rumbled. At Kvar's command, Bjorn was first out into the morning, dressed in his tribal leathers. He squinted into the dazzling light of the home star. Though his oculobe compensated for the glare, he wore a pair of goggles made from slitted hide, and his view of the world was restricted to a narrow band. Leman Russ strode past him without comment. An escort of 10 Wolfguard followed, led by Grimnir Blackblood. Then Kvar, at the head of a party of Goti. They were 8, all told, the oldest and most powerful of the rune priests, grizzled grey hairs, their long fangs flashing ivory in the dawn. None of them wore power armour. They were garbed, like Bjorn, in ritual leather gear and masks. Out of his battle plate, Kvar was all but helpless, and was carried by his twin guardians in a chair fashioned from mammoth ivory. Plates of bone and horn dangled from every neck, wrist and waist, carved with potent runes of protection. Russ stopped at the brink of the causeway and drew in a deep breath. The air was dry and warm. In the lower reaches, the temperature would be as high as the tropical norms of old Earth, even at the pole. At the equator, it rose so high as to be dangerous to human life.
A fine summer's day, said Russ.
Kvar's bearers brought him to a halt by the king.
The beginning of the end, said Kvar. At midnight, Fenris begins his journey away from the wolf's eye. He has warmed his hands too close to the fire and snatches them back. Winter will follow shortly after.
Russ looked over the planetary violence with an approving eye.
This is a hard world. This is our world, he said.
As it is in body, so it is in spirit, said Kvar. If we were not so hardened, we would not survive this undertaking.
He shook his staff. The wolf's teeth and bone fetishes rattled.
Downwards, he said. To the crack guard.
From anywhere but the Fang, attaining the summit of the crack guard would have meant an arduous ascent. But from the mountain housing the 8, every direction was down. The party moved in single file along the killing lanes of the sunrising approach. As the group descended, the peaks of the Fang's brothers grew, from modest-seeming crests to gargantuan masses of stone. That is, until Bjorn looked behind and beheld the endless majesty of the Fang itself, its great pyramidal form puncturing cloud and air. Through the clouds banking up against its eastern flank and the aurorae rippling over the summit, the lights of the fleet shone. They left the main causeway soon after, heading down steps hewn from stone. Cairns of skulls, wolf and human, guarded the entries to the many landings. Niches carved into rock held small ivory figurines of past warriors. The path went into the deep valley, dividing the crack guard from the Fang. By way of a single stone arch, without walls, they crossed a river, foamed with summer's flood 200 meters below. For a while they walked in humid shade. Mosses and ferns grew everywhere, expending last year's hoarded energy to put forth shoots and seeds and hoard again before the ice returned. It was hot, and the air so wet from the river's vapour, the Vilka's weapons beaded with condensation. Thereafter, the path turned upwards again, zigzagging skywards through black crags. The crack guard was the Vilka Fenrika's funeral mount, and possessed by a brooding spirit whose voice whispered just below the breath of the hot summer winds. Not long after beginning their climb, the first of the paths leading to the tombs of mighty heroes broke away from the main road, and after that they appeared with regularity. The party came presently to a hollow in the mountain, where the dirty tongue of a glacier pressed down from higher vales to lap at a tarn. Blue icebergs floated in the water. Black scree paved the ground with sword-blade shards. By the lakeshore was a ritual space, demarcated by poles of wood bleached grey and festooned with threads of space marine skulls. In the middle was set a pointed menhir, as tall as Russ, crudely hewn to resemble the fang. At the shoulder of the ridge, where the path turned downwards towards the tarn, a wide platform was cut into the stone. It was enclosed by a low wall and paved with slippery slabs. 100 wolf skulls sat on the wall facing outwards. They were from Blackmanes, the very largest breed. At the centre of the platform was a boulder as high as Bjorn's waist, polished smooth by years of human contact.
"The Wolfgat will go back to the valley and await the Primarch's return from the mountain by the bridge," said Kavar.
"We will not," said Grimnir.
His followers looked to one another uneasily.
"You cannot mean I should leave my Primarch."
"He does." "Obey the rune priest, Grimnir," said Russ.
He sounded weary and tense, thought Bjorn.
"Obey his command, as if it were my own."
"And what of Bjorn?"
said Grimnir, gesturing at him angrily.
"Bjorn will wait here, as sentinel," said Kavar.
He pointed at the boulder.
"You will sit upon the Rock of Vigilance and face towards the eight. Do not look into the corrie."
Kavar moved to address them all.
"We Goti shall undertake a struggle of the flesh and of the spirit that you cannot join. There are wards around this place. The skulls and the stone shall protect you, Bjorn. Do not leave them for any reason. You must not look into the corrie."
"Well, how am I to play witness if I cannot watch?" said Bjorn gruffly.
"Yes. Why does he get to stay, and we, the Wolfguard, are sent away?"
demanded Blackblood.
"She is to be the herald of failure," said Kavar to Blackblood. "Do you wish to take this burden from him? His is an ill weird. You may share it, if you want."
Blackblood scowled, his single eye turning flinty. He spat on the stone.
"No,"
he said.
"Then you will wait at the bottom," said Kavar.
He turned back to Bjorn.
"If Lord Rush does not return, it is you who shall take back the tidings of his loss."
"How will I know?"
"If he does not return by sunset, you will know. You will look away," said Kavar. "I do not care what you hear. You must not turn back, or any ill that befalls us will befall you too, and through you the Legion. If we are to fail, you must take the news back to the Eight. That is your task, no more. Wait until evening. Never look into the corrie, no matter what happens. Do not look."
"If that is my weird, that is what I shall do," said Bjorn. "Though I do not wish to have this fate."
"It is your weird, Bjorn the fell-handed," said Kavar, "and I am sorry that it is so. But the All-Father's weaving makes no allowance for personal feeling."
"One-handed,"
insisted Bjorn. He looked up fiercely, his temper finally breaking. He had had his fill of the Goti's inscrutable pronouncements.
"I am the one-handed."
He slapped the stump of his left arm.
"Why must you call me fell-handed? It is some kind of bad jest?"
Kavar gave him a guarded look.
"Because it is your name, Bjorn. It was braided into your weird the moment you were born. Follow your thread a little further, and you shall see that it is what you are truly named."
"Are we done?"
growled Russ impatiently.
"We are, my Jarl," said Kavar.
"Then, Grimnir, to the foot of the stair," commanded Russ.
Grumbling, the Huskarl directed his warriors away from the platform. Russ stared at Bjorn until the warrior took his place upon the stone and had turned away from the corrie. One by one, the goatee filed past, Kvar in his chair going first. Russ went last. He nodded at Bjorn as he went by. Bjorn listened to the clack of the goatee's bone charms dwindling into the distance. Russ's heavy tread followed. In the veil of the crack guard, sound was weirdly amplified. Russ's footsteps were as loud as an artillery barrage creeping over a battlefield. Hot wind stirred Bjorn's beard. His stump ached. He wished for his lightning claw to hide his maiming. He wished for a great many things.